The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon. I'm a Democratic strategist, a columnist for The Hill in Washington, D.C., and a political commentator for news radio stations KNX in Los Angeles and WGN in Chicago. You can read my column in The Hill every Monday at muckrack.com/Brad-Bannon. That's muckrack.com/Brad-Bannon. My company, Bannon Communications Research, polls for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. My company, Bannon Communications Research, is the sponsor of today's show. If you want to learn more about me, or if you have any ideas or suggestions about Deadline DC, you can reach, the best way to reach me is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Brad Bannon, all one word. Welcome to all of you who are watching me on Twitter and Periscope. Now everyone can watch the show by going to periscope.tv/Brad-Bannon. That's periscope.tv/Brad Bannon. Our guest in the first half hour today is Charlie Cook, publisher of the Cook Political Report. In the second half hour, our guest will be on our provocative progressive political panel will be Tara Devlin, the host of Tara Busta on Progressive Voices, and progressive political activist Mark Grimaldi. Now we bring our first guest on the show today. Charlie Cook is the founder and publisher of the Cook Political Report. Charlie is one of America's most prominent and shrewdest political observers. He is a frequent guest on Meet the Press and a columnist for the National Journal. Charlie, welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Thanks for having me on, Brad. This is my first time on to do it on Skype.
In this age, we are all doing technological first, even at our age.
Yeah.
That's tough. I know it's scary. I don't like it any better than you do, but we do what we need to do.
That's
okay,
right.
Let's start with the presidential race. Joe Biden has a lead nationally. He seems to be leading in many of the battleground states, too. It seems to me we've already got to the point where some people are on the Democratic side are doing a victory lap. What's your assessment of the presidential race, Charlie?
Well, I think it's I think it's bad luck to do victory laps until normally election night. But I think this could be a week or two, just because it's just going to take a long time to count votes.
Mailing ballots and everything.
Yeah. They've got states that have never had to deal with this before. But I think Vice President Biden is 8 to 14 points ahead right now nationally. He probably needs to be ahead by, say 3 or 4 points nationally for that to, be reasonably comfortably, translate into electoral college majority. He's ahead in basically every swing state except for North Carolina. This race has changed enormously since, say, late March, early April. That, back then, Biden had a lead. It was like 4, 5, 6 points. So it was sort of right above what it needed to be. But it was still quite competitive. And then you started seeing the president's approval rating start to slide for about a month into the coronavirus and the economic situation. And then you started seeing his trial heat numbers start to drop and drop into this range now. So, this isn't over, but I think the president's in a very, very difficult situation. His base is never going to leave him, but I think his ability to win over swing voters, independent voters, I think it's been really compromised in the last 90 days.
Okay. Of course, the president gave a speech at Mount Rushmore on Thursday, July 3rd. And it was very much, in my estimation, a speech that was geared towards base. It was basically a cultural war speech. It's us against them. They're trying to take away our American heritage. It seems to me that, again, it was probably, a great speech for his base. But he seems to be doubling down on the culture wars. Maybe he doesn't have any options. I don't know. Is that the way for him to put him back into the presidential race?
I'm not a name-calling kind of person, but if someone were to suggest that the president's a one-trick pony, I would have a hard time arguing with it. I mean, I think this is the only thing he understands, he knows. People, there's this feeling that he pulled off this miracle in 2016, when it was really sort of a perfect storm of factors, some of which had very little to do with him. He drew an inside straight and thinks he could do that every hand. And when you and I grew up learning politics and working together at a polling firm, that's 40 years ago.
Well, God, I was afraid you were going to say that.
We learned that politics was about addition. It was not about subtraction or division. This is just not how you go after swing voters. That when you get 46% of the vote and your opponent got 48%, and you're probably going to have fewer independent votes cast, so that you need to do better than 46. You don't do that by just myopically focusing on your base. And yet that's the only way he knows how to practice politics. And, I had a Democrat strategist say that he is a fantastic intra-party politician and terrible at inter-party, talking to anybody outside of his base. And I think that's absolutely the case.
Okay. Let me ask you about Joe Biden. He's obviously, we just discussed, doing very well at the polls. And he's done it. I think he's made, since March, he's probably made 3 or 4 public appearances. And that's it. Can that work through the long haul? Is he right? Is he just basic? It seems to me what he's trying to do is he's just keeping a very low profile, and basically believes that if he doesn't rock the boat too much, the Trump campaign will implode. Do you think Biden is correct in this kind of strategy?
Well, when I hear people say, well, Biden's got to get out there, it's like, no, he doesn't. Not to be catty, but every day he spends hanging out in his basement in Wilmington is a day he's closer to being president of the United States. And, people say, well, he's got to have a strong economic agenda. Well, heck, right, this thing is a referendum up or down on one of the most unpopular politicians in America. Why would you want to interfere in that process? And the other thing is, I think the American people are not in the mood. It's not the appropriate time to do traditional campaigning. I don't think they're in the mood for it. I don't think they'd pay much attention to it. It's a public health hazard to try to hold traditional political events. I wouldn't do a thing differently than what he's done already. And I realize it drives a lot of ideologues crazy and a lot of busybodies. But, this race is on a very good trajectory for him. And I don't know why anybody would want to change it.
Yeah, there seems to be a certain advantage. I mean, he has picked his spots for public appearances. And the contrast between Biden's appearances and Trump's appearances, like the one around Mount Rushmore on Friday, are pretty compelling in a positive way for Biden. I mean, here you had a man being very cautious, wearing a mask, and then you have Donald Trump going out and, you know, basically on a, you know, coronavirus festival tour. It seems pretty crazy, but I agree, it's working for Biden, so why rock the boat?
Yeah, I mean, this is just not the time. And also, I think the American people, they're looking for unity. When you have a crisis, normally that's a time when a president can turn things around that aren't going well, just, you know, like President Clinton and Oklahoma City, where people look for leadership, they look for unity, and they're not getting it here. And other world leaders saw their numbers move up. Most governors saw their numbers go up, whether they deserved it or not.
We've got to go to break now. When we get back from break, we'll have more with our guest, Charlie Cook. Radio audience, our guest in this half hour is Charlie Cook, founder and publisher of the Cook Political Report and a columnist for the National Journal. Charlie, let's turn to the Senate now. Donald Trump's decline in job ratings has apparently created opportunities for Democratic Senate candidates across the country. First of all, what kind of chance do you think there is that Democrats will take a majority in the Senate?
I think at the low end would be 50-50, and it's probably a little bit higher than that, but I try to be a little conservative on this. This has changed so much since the last time I came on your show. You know, 4 or 5 months ago, there was like a 1 in 3 chance, now better than 50-50. And it's a combination of the, you know, at back 4 or 5 months ago, Democrats had a good chance against Martha McSally in Arizona, against Cory Gardner in Colorado, against Susan Collins in Maine, and even Tom Tillis in North Carolina. But that was it. And assuming that Doug Jones loses in Alabama, which I think is a reasonably safe assumption, Democrats had to go 4-0 on those. And you know, it's doable, but it's hard. Well, what's happened since then? Number one, McSally and Gardner, I'd say Tillis and Collins, all four of them look even more vulnerable than they did 4 or 5 months ago. Then Montana has come online as a toss-up race with Steve Bullock getting in the race. Then you've got 2 live races in Georgia, and there is a legit chance for Democrats in each one of them. You could argue about which one's the better chance. Iowa against Joni Ernst. And then you get into, you know, some longer shots, but there are so many paths to 50, 51 seats for Democrats that it looks almost unrecognizable from how it looked 6 months ago.
Well, let me ask you about one of those Republicans. I saw Joni Ernst, the senator from Iowa, on one of the talk shows on Sunday. And she basically, when asked about Trump's handling of the pandemic, she tried to change the subject to and make it Barack Obama's handling of the Ebola crisis. And as the host pointed out, 2 Americans died during the Ebola crisis, and I think we're up to 130,000 deaths now since the beginning of the pandemic. Is that typical? Are these Republicans, you know, going, you know, down with Donald Trump, or are they trying to distance themselves from Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, what the hell do you want her to do? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard to defend the handling of the coronavirus. So she's got to say something. Not necessarily what I would have chosen, but you know, for these Republicans, and we've seen this, you know, you and I have seen this for years and years and years. When you have an unpopular president, it is a tough situation when you're running, you're an incumbent. If you trash a president of your party, you're just going to alienate the base. You're really not going to do yourself any favors with swing voters. But on the other hand, you know, if you just stay joined at the hip, then you go down with the ship, sort of. So it's how do you calibrate running parallel, keeping your own identity separate but not dissing? It's very, very hard thing to do. And, you know, people say, how do you do that? And the only thing I can come up with is very carefully, because it's not an easy thing to do. And it's been the same way for Democrats in other circumstances.
Yeah. Going back to Donald Trump, I remember reading in one of your recent columns, you were quoting a Republican strategist who said that Trump's best hope now is if the economy gets better. And, you know, hope is not a political strategy.
Yeah.
Is there anything, you know, besides hoping that Donald Trump can do?
Well, first of all, it's one of the most ironic things I've ever seen is we're in a horrible recession and you have an incumbent president who needs the focus to go on to the economy. And the simple reason is it's the only card. It's about the only card he's got to play. That every, you look at his job approval ratings, as you watch this stuff as close as I do, on every other subject, nothing comes close. I mean, where he's at least even on handling the economy, everything else, he's way upside down. And where he still gets some benefit of the doubt, or some, he still gets benefit from the tailwind that existed for 3 years. You know, I wonder what's the shelf life of a good economy when it's not good anymore.
Yeah.
But what the heck else is he going to talk about? And I think we've talked about this before. You know, his base is there. The base on the other side's here. For these swing voters in the middle, there was a group of them that they liked where the economy was, and they gave him complete credit for it. But at the same time, boy, they had some real doubts about him as a person, his character, his leadership, his presidential style. But the strong economy kept it in balance, offset it.
Yep.
But now you take that strong economy away, and I think the personal concerns go way, way, way up. And then now there's more of a competence thing with the coronavirus and all the civil unrest that this is just, you know, how many people think that things are going great right now? And the short answer is not any swing voters I've ever run across.
No, it seems like, you know, I think I remember recent Wall Street Journal NBC poll with 80% of the public thinks in this country are out of control. That is a deadly political environment for an incumbent. Charlie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Brad.
Our guest in this half hour was Charlie Cook, publisher of the Cook Political Report and also a columnist for the National Journal. We'll be back after these messages with our second half hour, which as always will be the Provocative Progressive Political Panel, this week with Tara Devlin, the host of the Progressive Voices talk show, Tara Busta, and our own progressive political activist, Mark Grimaldi. We'll be back with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon after these messages.
Follow Leslie on Twitter. Just go to www.twitter.com/LeslieMarshall. And we'll be sure to share your tweets.
Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. In this half hour, as is our custom, we have our Provocative Progressive Political Panel. Today on the panel is our friend Tara Devlin, the host of Tara Buster, and our own Mark Grimaldi, who's a progressive political activist. But before that, let me throw in my two cents. The United States faces an unprecedented threat to its national security. The biggest existential danger to our nation isn't the external military menace from the People's Republic of China or the Russian Federation. The major challenge for survival as a world power is the internal peril from the pandemic sweeping the nation and the economic devastation that trails in its wake. Senator Bernie Sanders recently proposed a plan to rebuild the economy. He would cut the Pentagon budget by 10% and use the approximately $75 billion in savings for economic improvements in poverty-stricken parts of the country. The progressive push for cuts in defense spending comes from an urgent need to rebuild the economy in the wake of the pandemic. The official unemployment rate is 11%. State and local government capacity to provide economic and medical relief is crippled by a sharp decline in tax revenues. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union devoted such a large proportion of its gross national product to its armed forces that its economy couldn't stand the strain. Now Russia is trying to live over its off its old glory. The same thing could happen to the United States if we don't change our budget priorities. If you want to read the rest of my column in The Hill today, Military Madness in the Age of COVID-19, you can Google muckrack.com/Brad-Bannon. Now it's time for our provocative progressive political panel. Today on the panel, our guest is Tara Devlin. Tara is a New York-based comedian, writer, and founder of Republican Dirty Tricks, also known as R-D-T Daily. Tara's unapologetically liberal weekly podcast, Tara Buster, is recorded live every Saturday evening at 6 p.m. on the RTD Daily Facebook and YouTube channels, and replayed starting Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Voices. You can follow Tara on Twitter at Real Tara Devlin. That's RealTaraDevlin, and on Instagram at Pterodactyl. That's TaraDacKtyl. Joining Tara on the panel is progressive political activist Mark Grimaldi, who has worked on Get Out the Vote operations for several Democratic presidential candidates, including Joe Biden. Mark is also involved in campaign finance reform and philanthropic efforts for cancer research. His Twitter handle is Mark J. Grimaldi. Okay, panel. Let's start with Bernie Sanders' proposal to cut 10% off Pentagon spending. Now, the very mention of cutting 10% of the Pentagon budget drew howls of protest from Republicans, saying that our national security is in grave danger, from who I'm not quite sure about that. And we need to increase the budget, the defense department budget, not decrease it. The military industrial complex is incredibly powerful, holds sway over Congress. Tara, let me start with you. What do you think of Sanders' proposal?
That he only wants to cut 10%? Is that all? That seems pretty conservative, in my opinion. How much money? How much more money do we need for this? The very thing that Eisenhower warned us about, the military-industrial complex. In fact, he called it the military-industrial-congressional complex. Has humanity hanging on a cross of iron? Will we ever heed those warnings? And what other government institution loses trillions of dollars? And that's one of the things that Bernie wanted to do, was to audit the Pentagon. But if the initial audits of the Pentagon is that they've already lost 35 trillion in accounting errors. Imagine any other company, public or private, that loses $35 trillion. It's a black hole. It's a pit that we really all are paying for. And I 10%. If this country puts more money into the military than how many other countries combined, I think we can afford
12,
it.
Actually.
Yeah.
The next the United States spends about $750 billion a year on defense spending. The next 12 countries on the list altogether spend less than that.
Right.
The second major spender is the People's Republic of China, and they only spend one-third of what the United States does.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, you want to weigh in on this?
Yes, a couple points. First of all, I think obviously we have to look past the current administration and their policies and see how the military budget would be utilized with future administrations that are hopefully a lot more rational, God willing, this coming January. However, what I would say is right now, because you have to look at what's being done right now, we have our own military being hunted by the Taliban with Russian bounties, and no one has stood up in the military, the active military that I've seen, and said enough and become a whistleblower or talk to the media or, you know, whatever you imagine would happen in a scenario like this. It's not happening. So there's a huge problem there in my mind. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they should be additionally rewarded with the same amount of funding, number one. Number two, I recall during the Obama administration, him scaling down parts of the military and talking about scaling it down more, saying we can't be a military that is built to fight two ground wars at once. We have other policies needs in this nation. And he listed many domestic policies that were worthwhile. And you saw a lot of support for that. And that was before you've seen the perversions of this administration play out on a grand scale across the world. The last thing I will say about this point is listen to the specific use of this money. Okay, it would first of all it would be for a grant program. Okay, so it's not like you're having the administration where you're just giving money to your friends, like the PPP loan program, but that those grants would go toward high poverty areas, number one. That's the most important thing. And the text of the bill lists building public housing, community health centers and schools, decontaminating drinking water, hello Flint, Michigan, and many other places we found, payroll for teachers, and the final thing is it prohibits money from being spent on prisons. I mean, just use that and ask, first of all, what American supports the same military budget with none of those things or taking just 10% off of that military budget when you talk about how big it is and focusing it on those things. And I think if that was somehow enacted or even part of it, you would see support for what Tara is talking about, which is further scaling it back and making it more lean. So I think it's an awesome proposal, especially right now when our country is devastated in so many areas with the pandemic that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Amen.
I must admit, Mark reminded me that I have a conflict in this discussion, which I should discuss. Mark said part of the money would be going to paying increased salaries for public school teachers in poverty-stricken areas. My daughter is a high school teacher in a poverty-stricken area school, so I would indirectly benefit financially from Senator Sanders' proposal. I want all my listeners to know that.
Brad, okay. I thought you were going to say it's because you were, although not public school, that you were that you teach political science at Salem State, but of course that's higher education. So yeah,
right. I thought you were going to say you were a weapons manufacturer.
Could you imagine, Brad?
In your spare time,
I have all sorts of conflicts of interest on this one. So, and I don't own any defense stocks either. So, but anyway. Okay, we're going to go to a break now for our radio listeners. We will keep going for folks who are watching on Periscope. And if you're listening and you want to watch on Periscope, you can go to periscope.tv/front/Brad Bannon so you can see as well as hear the broadcast. We are in the middle of our provocative progressive political panel. Our guests today on the panel are Tara Devlin, the host of Parabuster. If you're watching the show, you can see the Parabuster sign on her video there. And also progressive political activist Mark Grimaldi. Those of you who are listening and would like to watch, it's easy to do. All you have to do is go to periscope.tv/Brad Bannon, and you can watch the show as well as listen to it. Okay, let's switch subject now. Our guest in the first half hour, Charlie Cook, who is a prominent political analyst, thinks there's at least a 50-50 chance at the low end that Democrats are going to take back control of the United States Senate. And there's an issue if the Democrats do take control. One of the issues that the new Democratic majority would have to deal with is the filibuster rule. Because of the filibuster rule, it takes 60. It's nice if we'll say if the Democrats pick up enough seats to have, you know, 52-48 majority in the Senate. That's nice because it gives the Democrats control of the agenda in the House. But it's really not enough to get anything done in the Senate because of the filibuster rule, which means a senator can talk a bill to death. You need 60 votes in the Senate, really, to get anything done. Now, there's some talk among Democrats now, if they take back control of the Senate, to eliminate the filibuster rule. So if the Senate wants to pass something, it can do it with 51 votes instead of 60. Now, there's a downside to that. While the Republicans have held majority control of the Senate, the Democratic minority has been able to stop some Trump initiatives since the Republican leadership couldn't scrounge up 60 votes. A good example would be when Donald Trump tried to kill the Affordable Care Act a couple of years ago. I believe you had 54 senators vote to kill the bill, kill the law, which would have killed it since the House had already done it and the president would have signed it. But they didn't have the 60 votes they needed to kill the bill. So Democrats have to worry that if they do kill the filibuster rule, make it easier for them to pass legislation with 51 or 52 votes, that the tides could turn on them. The Senate could, the Republicans could take back control and do the thing, same thing, which would make it easier for them to pass conservative initiatives. So, Tara, do you think Senate Democrats should abolish the filibuster rule?
Well, it is a tough one only if the Democrats want to enact progressive initiatives. The whole thing is broken. Let's get this right out in the open. This system does not work for the working people. And for example, you know, even in the Senate, the House Democrats received 1 million more votes than Republicans, but now we're in the majority, but when we were in the minority, the Senate Republicans received 20 million less votes than the Senate Democrats, but they're still in the majority. So the whole thing has been rigged as it is. And we really can't get anything done with this extreme right-wing party that we're dealing with. They have absolutely no interest in governing for the majority of the people in this country. So as far as I'm concerned, should we eliminate the filibuster? It feels like so much more has to be reformed. But the point is, we need to get the working class needs to have a seat at the table, and we need to do as much as we can for the working people and before the Republicans have the complete ability to destroy and pull up the ladders behind them. This is what they do. When they get into power, they ensure that instead of, you know, if a Republican loses an election, they figure out ways to suppress the vote. They don't go around figuring out ways to build a coalition and have a functioning society to represent the people. They're working for the 1%. And as we know, the studies from Princeton, the wants and needs of working people have a statistically insignificant effect on government policy. So the filibuster only, we have problems with the Democrats too, in my opinion. We need a progressive party, like the party of FDR, that works for the working people. And we have to overwhelm this country with the progressive policies. And if that means getting rid of the filibuster, yes, but I don't know. My point is that there's so much more that needs to be reformed. And the filibuster, it's like we play this game that, okay, the Republicans might have the ability to roll back all the things that we do, but we really need to reform this entire system. Money in politics is really the root of the inaction and the intransigence of the Republican Party. So,
well, I agree with you.
That makes sense.
I think if there's ever going to be substantive, substantial substantive reform, it means limiting money in politics.
Yeah,
that is the root of all political evil.
Absolutely.
In this country. And as long as we have the finance system we have, it's going to be very difficult to change anything. Mark, what do you think about the filibuster rule?
I think Elizabeth Warren has actually made a very strong case for eliminating it while she was running for president. She has talked about how it's been used as a tool to block progress on racial justice. And I think right now that's a message that is very important to a lot of Americans, as thankfully they have shown in supporting Black Lives Matter and other basically racial equality policies that we've seen in the business world, in the private sector, as well as in the public sector. She actually told a story that was really interesting when she was at Al Sharpton's civil rights talk when she was discussing this. And she actually brought up the point that in 1918, the first bill to make lynching a federal crime was introduced, and it almost became law. It passed the House in 1922, but got killed in the Senate by filibuster, and, you know, happened multiple times after that. The other thing that you look at is Republicans set the record for filibusters back in 2013, 2014, with a record 218 filibusters in a two-year period. And I remember that, you know, very distinctly, because Mitch McConnell was doing it over and over. I mean, at one point, if you remember, I think it was in like 2012, he filibustered his own bill. It was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it's the height of hypocrisy. We see that it's impeding, you know, basic legislation during the Obama administration. And now you have an even more hyper-partisan environment.
Yep.
So it's only going to get worse. And when we're on the flip side of it, Mitch McConnell eliminates the use of the filibuster to get what he wants, to set up these majority votes. So what's the point of playing by rules if your opponent doesn't play by them? And
then
every time you're up to bat, you have to, you know, apply by this rule of, you know, you get two strikes, but I'll take four. Is that okay? No,
Hello.
Of course it's not
exactly.
Okay. So that's my hot take.
I agree. They've completely destroyed this. They have no interest in governing. Their goal is to drag us back to the system the founders rebelled against, where
the rich run and own.
Absolutely. They're still fighting the American Revolution. These are the loyalists. They want to concentrate wealth and money and power in the hands of a few and have the rest of us out here like the serfs, toiling in the fields and awaiting our rewards in heaven without having any ability to really have a seat at the table and know them by their fruits. So you're right. to why should we? That's the way Democrats are, though. We always bring a strongly worded email or a concerned letter to a goddamn gun battle.
Yep, it's got to change. So I think this is a good start. Like Tara said, it's a very small portion of a beginning of a much larger need, but I'll take it. Brad, you got about a minute left, Brad, so I'm going to let you take it home.
That finishes us for today. Thanks for watching Deadline and listening to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Thanks to our guest, Charlie Cook, publisher of the Cook Report, a Cook Political Report, Tara Devlin, the host of Terror Buster, and our own Mark Grimaldi. I'm here Mondays at 3 o'clock if the Lord is willing, the creek don't rise, and Donald Trump doesn't declare martial law. This is Brad Bannon. Stay strong, stay safe, and don't drink the Clorox or the Kool-Aid. I don't care what the president tells you. We'll see you next week at 3 p.m. Eastern. So don't miss the next episode of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon, or you'll hate yourself the entire week. And make sure you listen to Terror Buster, too. That will make her and her cat happy.
That's right.
Thanks, Tara. Thanks, Brad. See you later.
Thank you
very much.